It's very much like insider trading. What the market responds to, how to pitch projects, what an effective general meeting looks like, all from the other side of the desk. It was an education of how movies are made.
If you are a creative in the entertainment industry looking for inspiration and practical ideas about how to take the next steps in your career, you are in the right place. My name is Rebecca Doyle, and I work in film and television in Los Angeles. I learn so much from the ups and downs of the talented, innovative people surrounding me, and I want to share those insights with you. Join in every other week to hear the break-in stories of people who overcame challenges and found unconventional avenues to pursue their dream careers in an industry that has no set path. Today's episode is all about film and TV development, and we are getting specific from someone who has had success both on the writer side and on the creative executive side. Today, our guest is bringing real-world experience in getting into the creative executive path versus the screenwriter path, and the realistic feasibility of doing both simultaneously, how to get the attention of producers and managers, the blacklist website versus contests versus querying, how to crush a general meeting, how to develop great relationships with executives, if you should ever write for free when starting out, securing life rights for true stories you want to develop for the screen, if it's still necessary to move to LA for a career in entertainment post-pandemic, and his unconventional path to creative executive. Hint, it wasn't the assistant route. Mike Grimm is a writer of over 30 screenplays who focuses on heartfelt, humorous, spiritual, and cathartic stories, especially in the coming-of-age genre. In development, he currently has a fantasy time loop animated film with POC Studios, with Oscar winner Carl Reed, Hair Love, producing, a coming-of-age comedy in development with Oscar-nominated producer Sean Reddick, Get Out, Black Klansman, a coming-of-age spec at AGC Studios with State Street's Bob Title, Barbershop, The Hate U Give, producing, and a young adult spec that became set up at Wayfarer Studios after Sabrina Carpenter signed on to star. He's also developed projects for Gunpowder and Sky, Mar Vista Entertainment, and Sony Worldwide Acquisitions Department. He wrote two recently produced films, The Gift of Peace and The Blessing Bracelet, which were Hallmark's first collaborations with Christian-focused Dayspring and are now available to stream on Peacock. Mike also recently left his creative executive position at Wayfarer Studios so he could focus exclusively on his writing. He's still on great terms over at Wayfarer. Like I mentioned, he has a project set up there and has a ton of insight on how to best set yourself up for success having been on both sides of the table. What I also love about Mike is that every single script he has in development or that has been produced and that we're talking about today was his original idea. So if you're someone who's tired of waiting for an opportunity or for someone else to recognize what you know you can bring to the table, I think you'll find inspiration in how Mike took control of the things he could control to create his own opportunities. Let's jump into the interview. Mike, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Rebecca, happy to see you again and happy to be here.
So you are one of the most prolific writers that I know. We could talk about any of your 30 scripts that you've written, but let's start with the ones that are currently the most exciting for you.
Yeah, so there is an animated script that I wrote. It's a time loop movie, which is a challenge in its own right to try to write something that constantly repeats itself without being repetitive, but it got picked up by a studio and is now in pre-production. I just saw an animation test on it. I saw some character designs, a landscape. Oscar-winning producers is running it, so super exciting.
And how long ago did you write the first draft of that script? Because I think I remember reading a draft almost 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was like 2018, just to give you a sense of like the typical timeline for a script to actually go anywhere. But yeah, I think I wrote it back slightly before the pandemic. And it was one of those situations where I kind of had it sitting around for a while. And then a friend who I had worked with as an executive started a job at a new company who was looking for animated scripts and asked if I had any because he'd read something else of mine, and lo and behold, you know, hey, I've got this time loop movie that I'm pretty proud of, and they flipped for it, and I did a rewrite for them, and now we're cooking. It's called Once Upon Again. Actually, Tracy, my wife, came up with the title, and she'll remind me constantly. It's a good name.
Yes, it is. Making sure Tracy gets the credit she deserves. And you also have a couple of films that have actually been distributed recently, which is no easy feat, you know, going from script, actually getting it produced and then coming out. Can you tell me about those two films?
Yes. So a Christmas Hallmark movie called Gift of Peace aired in December. That was the first thing that I had gotten produced. It was super cool. We had a premiere at St. Monica's with red carpet and popcorn and candy and whatnot. And that film did really well for them. It was Dayspring, which is their Christian card company. It was their first film. So it did well for them. And then they asked me to come in and help with their second Dayspring movie, which was called The Blessing Bracelet, which they wanted to air on Easter. So they had me come in and punch up the current draft. So I got a co-writing credit on that.
And two things I want to highlight about those projects that I love. Could you tell me the names of the characters in The Gift of Peace?
So Gift of Peace is Michael Graham was the handsome guy. And the beautiful grieving widow was Tracy Fremont, which my name's Mike Graham and my wife's name, maiden name was Freelo, Tracy Freelo. So when we had our crowd, that got a big laugh. So it's fun to be able to put little Easter eggs in your script. So Mike and Tracy may or may not fall in love by the end of that movie. I want you to watch it. But no, that was super exciting. And it actually got awarded what's called a Christopher Award, which comes out every year. It's been around since like the 1940s. And it awards like the films that highlight the human spirit for that year. So that was really cool to get an award like that. But again, just the log line of it is a woman loses her husband the year before. And her friend suggests that she goes to a support group for the bereaved. And she creates a community there, and together they lift each other up as it's leading towards Christmas and this art gala that her and her husband used to do together. So that's kind of your ticking clock. But it was fun to write because my mom is a bereavement counselor. So I actually got to tap in and work with my mom as kind of a script consultant, unpaid. Sorry, mom. But she helped me make sure that the situations and characters felt accurate. So that was a fun little bonus to being able to write that film.
Yeah, lots of personal experience in that script. And I also wanted to highlight, maybe you want to shout out who connected you to Hallmark there, because that's also a personal connection from the place where you ended up having the premiere.
Yeah, so Emily Merlin is a friend from St. Monica's. I could sing her praises all day. She's an amazing exec. She knows Hallmark back and front. She's just a wonderful human being. And she's the one that approached me. She had read a rom-com that I wrote back maybe like 2017, 2018. And just in 2021 was when Dayspring was like, hey, we want to write some Christian fare for Hallmark. And she knew that my faith was important. So she asked if I had any ideas. And from there, we developed some ideas that she could send up the chain. And the one that, you know, felt good for her bosses was The Gift of Peace. So yeah, shout out to Emily. She's awesome. She's getting married soon. So I know she's super stressed, but if you listen to this, Emily, thank you. And I'm confident we're going to work again soon.
Definitely. And St. Monica's, that's the Catholic Church in Santa Monica. Alessandra Conti on an earlier episode also mentioned some connections that she made there. So all of these personal connections coming to fruition in your work. So again, there are so many scripts that you have written and are working on and have in the pipeline. But I do want to touch on a couple of the ones with a little more traction before we get into your origin story.
Sure.
So On Hold, we currently have one that's based on a true story that you secured the rights to, correct?
Yeah. So yes, because of the writer's strike, it's on hold, but it's with a faith-based production company. It's a true story about a young man with Down syndrome who joins his high school football team in order to inspire his mom to beat her cancer. So it's very much Rudy, very much Peanut Butter Falcon, a little bit of like Fault in Our Stars with the terminal illness element. It's a real tearjerker, but it's also very winning. So I reached out to the dad like in 2018 on LinkedIn and just wrote a very passionate email after I'd seen the video of his name's Robbie scoring the touchdown and his mom just completely emotional on the sideline, and told the dad I used to work with kids with special needs. And it's a soft spot. And I'd love to tell more stories that highlight diverse protagonists like that. And he went on board, and it took 3 years, and we finally found someone that believed in the story and commissioned me to write it. But it was a lot of, as you'll hear probably throughout this podcast, a lot of passes and a lot of no's, but that made the yes extremely exciting. So excited to get back to that one, as I feel like it'll reach a lot of people.
Yes. And so before we move on to some of the other scripts, I just want to highlight, especially for anyone who maybe comes across a video or an article of someone's life What was that process like for securing those rights? You mentioned that you sent a LinkedIn message. What kind of things did you include in that message? And then what kind of agreements did you set up to last for those 3 years?
Yeah, good question. So the message was very emotional. Again, like I said, I've volunteered for kids with special needs. My mom for 12 years throughout high school worked one-on-one with a special needs girl named Kay Watson. So again, I just had a real soft spot for them. And I talked about those types of things, having volunteered and again, just being really moved by this story. And it felt like a scene in a movie. And I pitched some of my credentials as well. Here's what I've done. And he got back to me. His name's Chuck. We're very close now because we're talking about his story. And, you know, he doesn't knows nothing about Hollywood at all. So he had lots of questions like, you know, what's this look like agreement wise, just like you said. Luckily, I have an entertainment attorney, and I was able to tap into him and say, hey, I would love to tell this young man's Down syndrome story. What would an agreement look like? So he'd kind of a boilerplate and we adjusted it a bit. And from there, I sent it to Chuck and kind of talked him through as best as I could. I'm not a legal person. I brought Matt in, who my attorney is, to help with the fine details. But essentially it was saying, you know, I had the rights to shop around, and I created a pitch and a pitch deck out of his story and sent it out to executives, and we renewed it a couple times because each one was 12 months, but it was a shopping agreement, meaning there was no upfront money. However, if I was able to set it up, then a separate agreement between the production company and him would be created for life rights, which typically does have some sort of fee attached.
So you had the shopping agreement and basically exclusive rights to, you know, meaningful consultation with them.
Correct.
Great.
Yeah, exactly.
And shout out to Matt. Where is he at?
He's at Hanson and Jacobson. Yeah, Matt Levy.
Shout out to Matt Levy. Okay, and so there's also a couple of other projects that you're shopping right now. One is a sci-fi rom-com, which are not always genres that you hear together.
No, it was a really fun genre mashup. You know, I'm a sucker for rom-coms. I'm happily married now, but I was a hopeless romantic for a very long time and always appreciated the grand gestures and those beats that we know and love from rom-coms. So I kind of took that concept and flipped it a little bit on its head. And what if someone only got half of the grand gestures right? So it deals with an android who does just that. He's an imperfect android who his creator wants to create a perfect man. So instead of, you know, the dirty dancing leap, you know, it's an iconic rom-com moment. You know, he's this big Danny McBride schlub. So imagine him trying to jump into a woman's arms, even though he's supposed to lift her up. So it's he knows there's something there that he's supposed to do that's grand, but he keeps messing it up. So it was really just like a playground of a premise. And I call him playground premises because you get to have fun playing on the slides and the swings and the seesaw. Like, those are the types of ideas I love to explore just because they're fun and you get to play on all the equipment and just have fun with the premise. So yeah, that one on hold right now, but was getting some meaningful reads prior to the strike. So I'm excited to revisit that one once a deal is reached. That one's called Imperfect Man.
Just so that listeners can keep track of which script we're talking about.
Hopefully on deadline in 2024.
Counting down the days here. Okay, and then there's also a buddy comedy. What is that one called?
So that one's called Little Maya. One of my favorite movies growing up was Big Daddy, Adam Sandler, where he takes in Sprouse twins, but you know, they play the same kid. It's about these two guys who are struggling with their own problems in their life, and they ask for a miracle. They pray for a miracle, and the next day a little girl shows up in their loft claiming that she's a guardian angel, and if they do what she says, she'll grant them each a miracle. So no idea who this girl is. So it's got a very much like a Three Men and a Baby vibe, which I feel like is a very winning formula where you have these hapless men trying to take care of a child. So that was another one that we were just starting to get out to some production companies prior to the strike. So both very exciting prospects. So to be continued.
Yes, definitely. And then you have the script that actually was one of the ones that you first moved to Los Angeles all those years ago for, that is also being shopped around. Jack's Final Five. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So Jack's Final Five, that's kind of my baby. Writers talk about having a calling card, meaning that one script that's a really solid writing sample that can help you get into rooms and get you general meetings. And Jack's was the first one that did that for me. The easiest way to pitch it is if Superbad and Fault in Our Stars had a baby, this is what the baby would look like. So right now, yes, it's currently under option with an Oscar nominated producer, and it's something that we're excited to take out post strike. But yeah, that one definitely opened the most doors for me out there, out here, I should say.
So that provided some valuable experience. You said your first true development experience was a script that's had a long journey, still not completed yet, and that's Action. What can you tell me about Action?
So Action, yes, that is a journey. And it started back in, I think, 2016, where Jack's Final Five introduced me to an exec named Lawrence at State Street Pictures. And State Street has done the Barbershop series. They did a movie called Beats for Netflix. So I had a general meeting with him. And what I learned in most general meetings, the writing got you there, but they're not actually looking to make the movie of the script that got you the meeting. Typically, they're just looking to fill you out as a writer and as a human being. And you as a writer are looking for what their needs are. And they happen to be looking for, basically, they said, we want a modern day Breakfast Club set in the city. And it started like that. And then I pitched them a couple ideas. And there was one that they liked about a kid who was from the city, wanting to go to film school, wanting to be the next Spike Lee, not having a ton of resources, but needing to create a submission video. So his kind of never do good buddy convinces him that he's going to get the best, most authentic footage at this annual jam. So it's about these two buddies trying to get to this jam downtown. And it's told kind of like Project X. Like a found footage film, which is hard to write because you're thinking about like, okay, you can only see the POV of the camera, but like it's a very, you're just trying to figure out, you know, not that you're directing it, but you know, you only have a limited point of view. So anyways, we developed that for, and another exec, Mitch, by the way, was in on it too. I got a shout out to Mitch, who's in New York now, but
Mitch who?
Mitch Smith. He worked at a company called 51 Minds at the time. They are no longer involved, but I think their CEO is still on as a EP. So we developed that for, I think it was 2.5 years. And I counted, it was 17 drafts that to get to the one that we actually ended up taking out. Not all of them were page one rewrites. Maybe only 3 or 4 of them were. Maybe 3. I know you know, Rebecca can't see her look, but she's like, 4 page one rewrites. maybe it was like 3 page one rewrites. But it was a lot. The point is, it was a lot of drafts and it was on spec. I did have producers attached. I think the important thing for me was I felt like they were giving back and putting effort in as I was as well. Because there's a debate whether you should write for free or, you know, do dollar options or anything like that. And I think you value yourself as a creator, but especially starting out, I was young. This was 6 years ago. I knew hardly anyone coming out here. I had to be as opportunistic as possible. And the writing process is something I genuinely enjoy. I was going to write stuff on spec anyways. So if I could have these producers attached with an end goal in mind, I was down to put the effort in. So yeah, 2.5 years and 17 drafts later, we took it out into the world and it got a bite pretty quickly from AGC Studios, who's Stuart Ford's company, and they brought me in and I pitched a rewrite, or I pitched kind of my vision for a rewrite for basically a comedy punch up. And so I got a studio rewrite, which was super big at the time for me. And once the script was pretty much locked in, it was the process of waiting for a director. That took probably 6 months. Then we had a director on board, and then they got an offer from one of the studios, but it was $2 or $3 million lower. And then, oh, whoops, COVID, force majeure, which is a part of the contract, which is if there's an act of God, the option gets extended without needing to repay it. So we were actually pretty close to having it greenlit, and then that halted everything.
You were viewing casting tapes at one point.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yep. They had a casting director send all these tapes. They even went to downtown LA with the two actors that they had chosen and shot a 5-minute scene just to get a sense of the comedy and the sizzle, which I thought was super cool. And I'm like, this is it. Yeah. So they shot a scene downtown and we started shopping it around. And I remember, I think on 3 separate occasions I got calls from my manager, and this was no fault of his, but he was like, hey man, this is it. This thing's going to happen. Like, you know, Netflix is given an offer or Amazon. And each time I was all, you know, super hyped up, super excited as anyone would be. And then something happened, whether the director dropped out at one point, which can obviously push it. I forget what other reasons it didn't make it. But I think for me, the highlight of it, and this was a 5-year journey, a Deadline article actually hit in 2018, which was kind of cool. That was my first Deadline article, which, you know, had a little tidbit about the project. You're like, oh, I'm legit. You post it. Everyone back home's like, oh, he's doing it. But yeah, Spike Lee read the script, which was cool. It made it all the way up. His execs at 40 Acres and a Mule loved it for like his Netflix incubator program. Spike passed. It's all good, Spike, if you're listening. Yeah. The fact that you read my script is pretty freaking cool. So I got a pass from one of the goats, which is probably the highlight for me throughout that experience. But most recently, so they renewed the option, I think 4 times. So they believed in it, which was great. But most recently, at the top of this year, the rights reverted back to me, meaning as a screenwriter, I get the script back. The only unfortunate thing is all the notes from the rewrite at the studio, I have to go to the draft before that. So when you get the rights back, you have to go back to the original draft that you did on your own. So anyways, I feel like there's still, like, it's a fun script. I'm proud of it. It's a great writing sample. It's at this point, it's 6 years old, and how much, like, so much changes culturally in 6 years. So I'm thinking of doing a 2023 pass. State Street Productions, Bob Title's the producer. They're still interested in taking it out once I go back and revisit it. So that's what I'm going to do. And I've done that for a couple scripts, and time away is one of the best things you can do as a writer, taking time away from a project and then going back and seeing, oh, wow, this was either really not good and needs a punch up, or there was something here. It just needs a couple more tweaks. So the more experience you get, you learn to go back and look at old projects and see if there's maybe a diamond in the rough that you missed before. So that's action.
Okay, so something I want to touch on for this script particularly, and mm-hmm. this applies to several scripts, but this was the first one. How did you not get incredibly jaded? Because I've heard from a lot of people the first time they go through this, it's just very disappointing when you think something's going to happen and then it doesn't happen, and that's going to happen, and it's not going to happen. And I think as people progress through their careers, they just accept that this is something that's going to happen repeatedly. But in the beginning, it's incredibly frustrating for people. It's really demoralizing for people. And I'm sure it took some time to come to the attitude of, oh, you know, I'm going to reinvent this. This is still exciting. People still believe in this. I still believe in it. How have you managed to not get overly jaded?
You think I'm bitter, Rebecca? No. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, isn't that the truth? And it does take time. I'll say this, a couple things. But one thing that immediately comes to mind that I've had to teach myself is to fall in love with the process, not the results. Because if you're super only focused on getting that produced feature or whatever the end goal is, you're going to be disappointed probably 95% of the time. So if you fall in love with the process and just find joy in, you know, the rewriting and all those sorts of things because you truly love the craft, it makes it a lot easier. Now, even still, I think what I've learned to do is redefine what a victory is in this business, because it's easy to be like, oh, optioning a script is a victory. Getting a project greenlit is victory. I mean, that is like a massive, massive, massive win. And if you have that as like what a win is, again, you're probably going to get pretty defeated because those do not happen very often. So for me, like, a win now is a pass, meaning someone read my script and took the time to check it out and gave me a pass. Like, that to me is something to be celebrated. And, you know, I think over time, it was just one of those things where I did find myself becoming a little bit embittered and jaded, and who wouldn't be? And I think it was because I was focusing on the things that weren't going right and things that I couldn't control. As soon as I shifted my mindset, what can I control? Oh, well, I can brainstorm some new ideas for a rom-com. I can work on this script. I can do a rewrite here because I love writing. Let's focus on that as opposed to these devastating lows. And I think I realized after I got married, I got news that any writer would be extremely proud of, and my reaction was incredibly muted. And my wife Tracy's like, are you kidding me, Mike? Like, this is huge. Like, you need to celebrate this. And I really needed that reminder. I was like, wow, you are crushing it. Like, yeah, you're gonna have these things that don't work out, but, you know, you get to choose what you focus on. and focusing on the positive of a win, like with the animation thing, the Once Upon Again thing. I remember my reaction was very kind of reserved, and she was like,
you mean your reaction to hearing that someone was interested in?
Yeah, yeah. And like, this is what I love to do. This is what feeds my soul. And you can't let those lows and no's take that away from you, because it will devastate you, and you know, quite a few people may give up because of that. So those, they're going to come. You're going to have those all lost moments in screenwriting terms, the belly of the whale, right? And what do all movies have? They have that third act rally, and you have to find that rally in yourself, however that is, whether it's focusing on a new script or doing something else that you love. But it's inevitable that you're going to have these things that will make you jaded. So now I have the approach of just being cautiously optimistic and still, again, having those mini victories, mini celebrations, because every time you think this is it, there's always the chance that it's not it. So you can say, oh, I hope this is it, but if it's not it, I'm not going to stop doing what I love.
Okay, and before we get into the double life you were living, like like Hannah Montana.
Double life.
I want to talk about Rocket Boy.
Rocket Boy, yes. So this is another story that has a protagonist on the spectrum, an autistic boy whose brother ran away a few years prior. He doesn't know where he went. And then the neighbor girl next door, who's on house arrest for something she did, forms an unlikely friendship with him. And together they sneak out and try to find his brother. So I was really trying to channel John Green, the author of Fault in Our Stars and Paper Towns. I think he's a great comp for my writing. He does a really good job of finding heart and humor and heartbreak. And he's someone that I really try to emulate. But anyways, Rocket Boy, that was a script that I sent to Justin Baldoni. And you'll hear his name pretty soon again in this podcast because I worked for his studio. But I sent it to him just as a creative and respecting his creative opinion. This was back in, call it 2020. And months had gone by and he didn't get back, and he's a very busy man, and I didn't hold anything against that. Getting back to someone is something that doesn't often happen in this business. And all of a sudden I get an email. He goes, "Hey Mike, great news. I sent your script to Sabrina Carpenter. They'd worked together on a movie called Clouds. She loved it. She wants to star in it. Like, let's take this on our slate." So out of nowhere, Rocket Boy actually got optioned by Wayfarer Studios. Since then, Sabrina's been very busy with her music tour and had to drop out. So they're in the process of trying to repackage that. But again, that was just one of those things where I sent it to someone for creative feedback and it ended up in an actress's hands and got optioned. So just kind of put it out there into the universe, and he responded to it. And that's another kind of coal in the fire. And I always try to keep as many coals in the fire as possible, meaning projects that are in various stages of development or ones that I'm working on. That way you're not just laser focused on, please let this one project be the one. That's a very detrimental approach. You always want to be thinking, what's the next thing I'm working on? Or, you know, we've got these four projects out there. How can I service one or the other? So yeah, Rocket Boy. Yeah, that's a fun one. I'm hoping that one can get to the finish line.
And how many years has it been since you wrote the first draft of Rocket Boy?
I think like 2018, okay. 2019, I wrote it and did a couple rewrites on it. And then it's one of those things where it made its way around town and got passed on, got me some meetings, which was great. But I always had a soft spot for it. And a lot of times it's just getting it in the right person's hands at the right time.
Totally. Yeah. Okay. And just add some context to Rocket Boy being optioned by Wayfarer. When you say that you sent this to Justin, you're talking about Justin Baldoni, who was actually your boss at the time, at the company where you're a creative executive. So this is something that people think about and talk about all the time when they have a real passion for screenplays and maybe an interest in writing. There is a path towards becoming a creative executive and a path towards becoming a screenwriter. And the conventional advice is always that you have to pick one and can't do both. And I would always mention your name as an example because you're doing both very successfully, to the extent that you were able to leverage your creative executive relationships into getting your screenplay optioned, which I'm not sure you would advise that
not necessarily. I think it's how you frame it. Like, I literally just said, hey, I would love your creative feedback. I wasn't like, hey, does Wayfarer want to option this? And then he made the decision to send it to someone. So I think in that sense, it's not really a conflict of interest. It's just a friend asking another friend to give feedback on a script.
Yes, definitely. And it's not that I don't think you were under the impression that doing the creative executive work was inherently advancement for screenwriting. You were actively writing alongside the creative executive work.
Yeah, yeah. I really did want to keep those two lanes separate because, yeah, it felt like a conflict of interest to just be like, oh, I met this executive from 21 Laps.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to go send him my script on the side. It just, that feels very icky to me. And that's not, I don't think that's how it should be done. So I definitely kept those two things separate. There were a few cases where I would be chatting with someone and the topic of creative pursuits would come about and I'd mention I was a writer and they'd be like, oh, you know, send me something whenever you want. But it wasn't something that I would ever advertise when I was in a meeting. I had a job to do as an executive and that wasn't to try to promote my own scripts. So I always put that away and kept that very separate while still pursuing the writing, just not integrating that into my role as a executive story editor, which is like synonymous with creative executive.
Yeah, definitely. And at the same time, you were gaining all this experience knowing what executives were looking for in writers.
Yeah, it was very much like insider trading and learning like what the market responds to, how to pitch projects, what an effective general meeting looks like, all from the other side of the desk, how to give better notes. It was really like I was just a sponge. For me, it was an education of how movies are made. And to be honest with you, no offense, Rebecca, I had no interest in producing at all. I was like, stay away. Hate that. There's way too much going on. But I didn't know. That was before I was an executive. And when I was an executive at Wayfair, I was on a bunch of projects as a junior exec and doing all those things in pre-production and being on set and post and watching cuts and giving notes on the cuts. And when it's all said and done, I'm like, you know what? Maybe I want to produce someday. Like, not now, but maybe in like 5 years, like I could get in that side because you're really just, you're putting things together and you're making it happen that way. Very organizational, which was never my strong suit. But anyways, that job really opened up my eyes to what producing is and that it's not as horrible as I thought it was.
So you mentioned some of these lessons that you learned. What are some of the lessons that you would pass on to other writers having been on the executive side? You mentioned, yes, you know, what makes a good general meeting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. You know, was this a 5-hour episode? Let me try to give you some of the main ones. One thing is taking a pass with grace is very important. There are many, many times where we would pass on something and there are a million reasons for passes. And when I say we passed on 98% of submissions, we passed on that many. Out of 100 submissions, we might take on 2. So there's never any reason at all to take it personal as a writer. There's just so few slots on the slate. But a bad look is when someone tries to convince you that this is the perfect project for you. And, you know, it's almost like they know your company better than you do, as opposed to just saying, thank you so much for the read. We'll look for something else to do together. So taking a pass with grace is super important, and humility. I'll also say that the phrase, everyone in the industry always says it, hurry up and wait, is 100% true. Extended beyond like hurry up and wait and wait and wait some more is what I would say, just because things take a very, very long time. And I made the mistake as a writer before I was an exec of checking in too often on projects. And I realize now you just need to chill. Like, I don't think there's any problem if you have a script with a company checking in every month or two, but things take time. Like getting reads from directors and attaching a director, 3 to 6 months is pretty typical for that, because you have to field meetings and the meetings get pushed and then, you know, the whole business. So that was something that I learned, like patience to the umpteenth degree is super important. Again, enthusiasm is great and checking in is, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's something that, know that the executives are working hard. Your script's on their slate for a reason. And like our slate was 45 projects. I wasn't on every single one of those, maybe about half of them, but I also ran the story department because we were a new company. So there's a lot of hours in a day and an exec's time is very valuable. So if they take the time to read your script, that deserves gratitude. Like, that's something that I'm like, oh, it only takes an hour and a half to read a script. Like, just, you know, take a little bit of time and read it. But I didn't understand that an exec's queue is 40, 50, 100 scripts long.
Totally.
At some point,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So time is so, so valuable. So any read, that's why I consider a read a win now, even if it's a pass, because I know how valuable that person's time is. Another thing I'll mention is someone early on when I was a writer told me, like, you have to grab them in the first five pages. As an exec, I would read past page five, but I think I had a pretty good grasp by page five or 10 if that writer had command of the page and if their story was going somewhere. I think one of the biggest reasons for passes is nothing happened. It sounds kind of silly to say, but in 30 pages, there was no North Star. Like, what is this character trying to accomplish? What are the stakes? You know, all those things were missing. So it's very true. Within the first five or 10 pages, I had a very good grasp of if this writer really knew their story and knew where it was going. So that's something I heard early on that I was like, well, it's five pages. That's not a lot. But you do, when you read as many scripts as an exec does, which I would average maybe 20 a week, 25, because there's this nasty thing called weekend read, which is homework.
That's Tracy's favorite thing.
My wife hated it because every Sunday afternoon, I'm like, well, I got weekend read, time to read seven scripts. Basically, weekend read, it's a memo that goes every Friday and it has submissions of the week that you need to read over the weekend and be able to report back on Monday and say, hey, here's something we can should consider and why. Here's why it's a pass. And on light weekends, it was probably three or four. On heavy ones, it could get up to 10 things to review. And sometimes books. And books take a long time to read. So anyway, execs are working very, very hard because that's reading script is one thing, but you're also creating director's lists. If you're in production, you're watching dailies, which is all the shots for the day, you review them, and then you pick out what you think are the best and create a folder for the higher execs. It's called a selects folder. Imagine doing that upon all of your other duties. You're checking availability. A lot of it's administrative. When I thought I was going to be an executive, I was like, oh, I'm going to be giving notes all the time and, doing this really fun creative stuff. The really fun creative stuff was about 10% of the job. The other 90% was a lot of producerial things. Creating those lists, logging scripts, creating production memos, taking notes on meetings, general meetings, which were fun, and I can talk about those. But it's just, as an exec, I had a much greater appreciation, just like when I used to be a teacher, I had a much greater appreciation for teachers. When I was an exec, I had a huge appreciation for execs and the amount of creative energy they have to expend. So the fact that any exec is giving your script or your project the time of day, that's a huge deal. So I have so much gratitude now that I'm focusing on writing again. Anytime I do get a read, most of which are passes, I'm like, thank you so much for your time. Can I buy you coffee, soon? It's just a new appreciation for what they do. Whereas I took that for granted before and was like, why aren't you moving my script forward? You know what I mean? So it gave me very valuable perspective of that.
Yeah, definitely. And when you said that you could talk about the general meeting. Yeah.
Yeah. General meetings. A general meeting, by the way, is meant I liked your writing and I want to meet you as a writer. If we want to option the script or take the script on our slate, that's a separate conversation. So it's important to know if you're getting a general meeting, it's really just for the exec to feel you out, not only as a writer, but as a person. Because what you realize as an exec is when you are taking on something for development, you are going to have a relationship with that writer for very likely more than a year, sometimes multiple years. So it's really important that you connect on a certain level. It's really about creating a relationship with the exec. You want to do your homework going into those. I knew if someone had known about what Wayfair Studios was about, they would mention movies that we had done in the past. I don't want to call it an interview because it's not like question answer. It's a conversation, but you want to be prepared when you go to an interview to ask about, what sort of projects are you looking for? What are some no-fly zones? Meaning what's some content that you won't do? Like Wayfair, we didn't do horror. We wouldn't do any movie with a body count. We said no girl dragged from a lake. Those are things we wouldn't do. But at the end of the day, it's like my advice for a general meeting is just be yourself and be someone you would want to work with for a year and a half or 2 years. After a general meeting, I have a pretty good idea of what this person might be like if I'm working with them on a project. So general meetings are great. Again, it just means you're on their radar. Oftentimes from a general meeting, someone would come back to me with some ideas, because we were looking for maybe a Guardian Angel script, or we were looking for a imaginary friend script, and they'd come back with some ideas, and that's how the development process is born. I would say, oh, there might be something here. Let's look at it. So it's really just getting on an exec's radar. And if you're working on something, which you should be as a writer, because every exec will be like, okay, I loved your last script. What are you working on now? And if you're like, about that, I'm binging, Manifest, like, wrong answer. You want to be having something that you can say, like, all right, my next thing that I'm really excited about is X or Y. And as an exec, that's very appealing, because I want to read your next thing. So generals they're just important for you to get on people's radar in the hopes of potentially developing something down the road, as opposed to thinking the script that got you the meeting is going to all of a sudden get produced by that company.
Yeah.
So hopefully
yeah.
That's helpful.
Yes, definitely. Now having been on both sides of those meetings. So your journey to Wayfair and becoming an executive, this is also a bit of an anomaly, because typically the conventional advice is become an assistant, your way up.
Work at the desk.
Definitely had the transition period into Los Angeles, where it wasn't all gravy from day one, but you did come into the executive role from a bit of an unconventional means.
Yeah. I joke that I got the fast pass. If you've ever been to Universal Studios, it's where you get to go to the front of the line.
Oh, I thought you went on the freeway.
Oh, both. Actually, it works for both ways.
Both of these are very LA.
Yeah. Freeway or Universal Studios. So I was working at USC, fight on. love the campus, by the way. Great fountains. I was working as a writing coach for the School of Social Work. So I was helping master's students with their thesis writing, which nothing to do with the industry. Yes, it was writing, but it was very technical. And it was a great job because it was super flexible and it didn't use that same creative part of my brain that I needed for writing. So I could go home and still put in an hour or two or three on a screenplay versus being an executive, which you can imagine is a very creatively taxing job. So I was working at USC, but I was also doing script coverage, which script coverage is basically a production company or a studio hires you to read a script and you evaluate it based on character, dialogue, structure, marketability, and you're writing a synopsis and you're writing comments. And as an exec, readers are so, so valuable, because you just get so many scripts and you can't read them all. So having readers kind of filter through some of the easy passes is a lifesaver. But I was doing script coverage and I'd done it for about 10 years. Again, it's a super valuable skill as a writer, because you learn a lot from bad scripts as much as you do good scripts. And Justin Baldoni, he brought me on as a script reader for him. This was back in 2018. So I was reading scripts for him just as I was working at USC as a writing coach. And in fall of 2019, Justin was working on Clouds, which ended up going on Disney Plus. Really, really great film. And he got me way more involved on the development of that versus just doing script coverage. So I was actually giving notes, whereas coverage is really just evaluating a script, not giving notes. And so he gave me more creative responsibility. And then the fall of 2019, the School of Social Work had to lay off half of their staff because of budget reasons. Unfortunately, the writing center and the writing coaches were part of that layoff. So I texted Justin. I was like, hey, man, I got a bunch of free time now. If you want to send me some more scripts. And he goes, you're not going to believe this. I just got a really large investment to start my own studio. I love your creative instinct. Would you want to be an exec of the studio? So I was like, fast pass, bam, right to the front of the line. And I was like, absolutely. And I mean, call it luck, but what do they say about luck? It's opportunity meets timing.
Preparation.
What is it?
Luck is where opportunity meets preparation.
Boom. There it is. So I had both of those things going for me. So it was very fortuitous and divine intervention in a way too. But I was all of a sudden a creative executive as a studio. And our first week of being an official studio was March 2020, early March, which we're like, all right, let's go. Let's build a slate. Let's change the world. And then the world changed, right? That was right when COVID was. So we were a COVID company. So our first year, I think I heard one in-person pitch, and then no one was able to go to work. That first year in particular was just being a sponge, because I didn't know really what it meant to be an executive. Like, I had the experience from coverage about evaluating scripts, but there's so many facets to being an executive and interacting with agents and talent and all those things. So it was really just being a sponge, but super grateful for Justin just taking a chance on me, because I didn't have that couple years of desk experience. He just really, we were in sync of the types of projects we both loved, and that was really important to him. And he took a chance on me, and forever, I'm forever grateful for that, because it was such a valuable experience for me, not only as a writer, but just as a, you know, as a human being. So yeah, that's the FastPass Wayfarer story.
So you were working at the school of social work as a writing coach. You were doing freelance script analysis, yep, story analysis, script coverage. And basically one of your clients decided they liked your creative taste and it aligned with an opportunity you had to bring you on as a full-time executive.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I would imagine very, very few paths, but again, that's why you created the aptly named No Set Path, right?
Yeah, definitely not set in stone or recommended to.
No, I don't recommend getting laid off and being a coverage reader and then texting your boss saying, "Hey, do you have a CE opening?" But that's how it worked out for me, and it was just a opportunity that I couldn't pass up.
Yeah, I think the other takeaway too there is that you had already laid the foundation through the other work. If you had had that layoff at the School of Social Work and thought, "Oh, now I need to start my script coverage journey," you know, it would have been a different story, but you had already spent all that time laying those foundations.
Yeah. Just always like hustling on the side. And again, I found script coverage extremely valuable as a writer. And actually the first thing that I covered for Justin was a book called It Ends With Us, which ended up being this massive NYT bestseller. And they're shooting it right now in New York. Blake Lively was announced as the lead, and Justin's actually getting back and acting in addition to directing.
Wow.
It's at Sony. So it's a huge deal for the company. So I'm like really proud of that. And I wish I could see it through, but circumstances changed eventually. But yeah, it was one of those things where I was just extremely grateful, because when I first moved out here back in 2015, I applied to probably 200 desk jobs, assistants, I mean, mailroom. You know, I wanted to get into development badly. And I think two people responded to me out of 200, because I didn't have a background in film and didn't have any desk experience. Everyone's looking for 1 or 2 years of desk experience. I didn't go to, you know, USC or have the internship opportunities. So to have this opportunity to be a development exec after 6 years was just a blessing. And so I couldn't pass it up, and I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah, definitely. And so even going back a little further, so when you landed the School of Social Work writing job, it's funny, right? Because in terms of hard skills, that probably required more than the assistant jobs, you know, qualifications.
Oh yeah, APA and doing tutorials and giving lessons. It was a lot of one-on-one coaching. So yeah, I would argue that it's definitely more assistance, a lot of scheduling and, you know, that sort of thing. So
yeah.
I'm a big grammar nerd, so it was like really tapping into that side of me.
Mm. And then how did you first get started in story analysis?
Back in college, I did an unpaid internship for a company that I'm not sure it's around, and I can't even remember its name in New York, but it was, I wrote an email, man, I'm going way back. Yeah. This was back in 2009.
Wow.
And I just did a cold email to this guy in New York, and he gave me, I think a script or two a week. It was unpaid.
What was in the cold email?
Oh, it was just, "Hey, my name's Mike. I love writing. You know, I did a sample coverage. I remember Googling it, and I read a script." Because it's easy to find most scripts online, by the way. And any writer, I recommend reading scripts in the genre that you want to write. It's super valuable, of ones that have been produced. But anyway, so I did a sample coverage based off of a script that I read. I wish I could remember the script. I think it was a Keanu Reeves movie. But anyways, I gave him a sample coverage, and apparently that was the fact that I took that effort and reached out to him. I think most people just simply sent a resume, but I went to find his email and sent an additional note, and he took a chance on me. So at 20 I was doing script coverage, and then coming out to LA, I read for a screenplay competition. I was a script reader for a screenplay.
And how did you get connected with that?
I think it was like entertainmentcareers.net or something like that. Just one of the generic sites. I will say this. I'm not going to say the name of the competition because they paid me $20 a script, which is highway robbery. But when you're starting out and just need to build your resume, it was less about the money and more about the experience.
Yeah.
So I was just cranking out and it was a competition. So most of the scripts were lower quality, but I got that. And then I applied for one at Miramax. And the reason I got that was the script they had me sample cover, or it wasn't a script that I sampled covered. It was the script that I sent as a sample. She had read it as well recently and had a very similar opinion on it, which I guess a lot of people really loved it, but she thought it was mediocre, which I did as well. So it was one of those things that was very fortuitous that she had just read it. And because when she hired me, she's like, I felt the exact same way about that script. I know most people didn't. And so we had that connection without knowing. So yeah, there's another sense of, I guess luck that I sent that script. But yeah, so then I went on to read for Miramax. And then from there, I had a friend who worked for an international distributor who needed coverage. And then from there, it was just, through friends that were looking for reads and whatnot. Mm. So I kept those gigs going. Like, there's always scripts. So it was one of those things that I just kept reading for years and years.
Right.
For 10 years, I guess, like 10 or 12 years. So I had a ton of reading experience over the years.
Yes. Okay. So you're doing coverage, but you did not move to LA to do coverage.
No.
There were some other catalysts in your journey. I mean, first of all, let's tell the listeners, where are you even moving from?
So I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. I grew up in Berks County, went to a little school called Ole Valley. I remember as a kid, and I've listened to a bunch of your other episodes, Rebecca, so I love how a lot of them would just take, a lot of your guests will just take their camera out and shoot stuff. I'm of the age of, we had the VHS camcorder, and this thing was like 15, 20 pounds. So like 10-year-old me had just like watched The Matrix, blew my mind. So me and my buddies, Jason and Mike Brown, we'd go out and create like Matrix ping pong and Matrix billiards. It would always be us playing a sport and like doing these shots with like a ball to a string and like freezing there while the camera went around. And it would always end in a Matrix battle. Like, one of us would always turn into Agent Smith and we'd have this crazy thing. And we'd always do, of course, the thing where he dodges the bullets. We'd start to lean back and then we'd cut. And then I'd be like laying on a table, but we'd be focused on my head being like perpendicular to the ground, and we have a marble on a string going over. I mean, these are absolute gems. We used to love doing that. My friend Joey Aquaviva, we made a movie called Flame of Skilbertson, where as this kid who had like Neo like powers, but there was a villain, and we didn't have much cast. I think he played the lead and then I played like 12 other characters, including like a ring wraith and Agent Smith. I mean, these are ridiculous films, but it was like very early on. We just loved going out and shooting things and editing things and then like making our parents laugh.
How old are you at this age?
Oh, we were probably like middle school.
Okay.
So like 11, 12. And when VHS, you had to like rewind. We didn't have editing software, so we had to like rewind where we messed up and there'd be all these jump cuts. But it didn't matter because we were just creating things. So
you would actually pause the scene and then change the angle.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was very like ragtag. Those tapes, the lost tapes, what I wouldn't do to like dig those up. I'm sure they're in like the cellar somewhere back home. But
so you're paging your script consultant, mammogram.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, yeah, we would always go out during the summers and shoot all these things. And it was just a lot of fun. And we loved, again, I think I'm a storyteller. I learned that I wanted to be a storyteller because I just loved making people feel something, whether it was joy and laughter or, you know, sadness and heartbreak. Like, there's something about connecting with a human that you don't know on that level that's incredibly appealing to me. And I learned that at a super young age. So anyways, we would always do that. And then through high school, whenever there was an option to create like a video element, everyone wanted to be in my group. Like, oh, Mike's going to create some crazy production, which we usually did. I think the name of the editing software was like Video Explosion. It was some like really kind of janky thing, but it did the job. Video Explosion. Shout out to them. I don't know if they're still making stuff. So throughout high school, and then I went to Penn State mainly because I just love the university and grew up going to football games. I didn't know too much about their film program, and it was growing. I mean, it's not, you know, ranked in whatever poll but it gave me at least a foundation of skills that I had the capacity to accomplish something on a timeline, which I think if we all look at our degrees, like, it just shows that you have the ethic to accomplish this degree. And then you learn so, so much by just going out and doing. The degree is like kind of the admission into the club, and then maybe not the club, but the degree is like the ticket to entry. And then once you get in, that gets you into the door. Because Penn State only offered, I think, 2 screenwriting courses at the time. And so the longest script we wrote, I think, was 10 or 12 pages. So it's not like we came out of there with a portfolio. And I wanted to actually move to LA after graduating from Penn State, but I'm a military child and military folks tend to be pretty risk averse. And my dad was like, well, do you have any money? No, I was many, many thousands in debt. I think I had like one crappy script to my name. So the timing just didn't feel right. So I went and got my grad degree in English education and got my master's in that. And I was an English teacher for a year, 9th and 12th grade. Mm. And in a cruel twist of fate, I got like the low level 12th graders, the seniors who were like already in college. And I was a young, like 22 year old kid, knowing what I was doing. So I call that year my character building year. That's like my positive spin on it. Cause it was so, I mean, thank your teachers. I was a good student. Whether you're a good student or a bad student, like, I have so much respect now for teachers, cause it's so much work to lesson plan and grade, and in English teaching is especially, you're reading a ton of thesis essays. I will say though, looking back, being a teacher prepared me in a big way to be an executive, just because there's so much organization, you're interacting with so many different personalities across the communication spectrum. So I'm very grateful for that year, but it was only a year that I taught, and it was very hard to write during that year as well. Cause I knew after college, I loved writing. It was something that I was going to do, even if I never made any money out of it, it brought me joy. So I got out of teaching after 1 year, and then I was a small business consultant, but again, always writing. And then my friend in LA, Jason Hellerman, shout out to him. He's a Penn State alumni. He told me about this website called The Blacklist, which is run by Franklin Leonard. So there is The Blacklist, which is announced every year in November, which is the top unproduced screenplays in Hollywood. And so he created a website where writers who wanted to break in could post their scripts and pay to get a industry read from a script reader just like myself. And if a script scored, I think, an 8 or above, then it would get sent out to this weekly email to over 900 executives. I was like, all right, I'll try it. And so I put 2 of my scripts up there, and at first they were getting not great scores, but I was really focused on the numbers back then. And that was a bad kind of way to go about it. The most valuable part is the feedback, because they give you the strengths. Here's what's working. Here are the weaknesses. And then here are the commercial prospects. I've learned it really turned my attention to that. But long story short, one script, Jack's Final Five, ended up getting a really high score. And all of a sudden, actual executives started to reach out to me. And one of their first questions was, where do you live? And Plowville, Pennsylvania was not the right answer. So literally lived in Plowville, to give you a sense of like the area that I'm from. It's in the boonies. And I lived down the street from a plow store. I used to be the Bachelor of Plowville, which maybe not the best name of a town for bachelor, but so. And then another script called Face that I wrote, which this movie Wonder didn't come out yet, but it's basically Wonder in high school very much. And I think that's why it will never get made, is because it's very similar. It's a kid with a facial deformity who is homeschooled, and then he's thrust into high school once his mom remarries. That was their featured script of the week or the month, where a graphic designer made a cool little movie poster and it got sent out to all the execs and got a ton of downloads. And again, people just started reaching out. And I think as a writer, you're constantly unsure of yourself. I know we're our own harshest critics. Like, is this actually any good? And when you start having legitimate people reach out from the industry saying, we love your writing, it started to give me the confidence that I needed to potentially make the leap. Particularly a producer named Lisa Bruce, who's amazing. She produced Darkest Hour, Theory of Everything, No Strings Attached, like a great producer. She actively developed Face with me for a few months. And she was really the one that kind of said, Mike, I think you would do well out here, but you have to make the decision to do so. So at that time, it was a me, not a we. It wasn't like I had a family
You hadn't met Tracy yet.
Yeah, no Tracy. Sad part of my life right now. And again, it was one of those things I was like, if I don't try, I know I'm going to regret this 10, 20, 30 years down the road. I know I am, because it's writing is what feeds my soul and an itch that I always have to scratch. So I think I had $10,000 saved up. I mean, one of your other podcast guests had like 10K. I don't know how far, you probably need a little bit more nowadays with inflation, but I had $10,000 saved up. And my friend Evan Littman, who was also a Penn State grad, him and Jason were the only two people I knew coming out here, but Evan happened to need a roommate at the time. So I moved in with Evan and did the whole starving artist thing. And obviously it's worked out. It's taken 7 years, by the way, which I heard is an overnight success in Hollywood, 7 years. So I just made the cut. But yeah, I made the leap from there.
Yeah, I think I remember you telling me about just the difference. I think you told me a story about when you had a dresser corner.
Oh yeah. No, it was the clothes corner, I called it, because I couldn't afford a dresser. I just like had my clothes like neatly stacked in the corner. I lived on an air mattress. You know, these are things that you do. That first year, I came out here like thinking again that Jack's Final Five or Face was just going to get produced. I was going to have a ton of money. But when in reality, those got me a few generals, but there was no option or any money that way. So I was like, oh, I'm going to be a screenwriter out here. And within 6 months, my bank account was like, no, you aren't. You got to figure out how to make this work. Because I learned very quickly that financial stress will really inhibit your creativity if you're worried about finances. Yeah, it's just the truth. So I ended up scraping by. I got a recruiting job for like 3 months, which sucked. And then I got to tutor for a well-known company out here. That was fun. I actually do that now as I'm writing, just as more consistent income. But it was just like that starting artist phase of being a Angelino, especially in the industry. You just scrape by and find time to do your creative craft on the side. But yeah, the clothes corner. Now I have a dresser. Finally. No.
Yeah, well, a lot more than that, too. Shout out to Tracy. We're currently in Mike's beautiful home in Los Angeles, and Tracy has really done a fantastic job of the interior design.
She is, I call her Babe the Builder instead of Bob the Builder. She's very, very good at making a house a home. So very grateful for that, among many other things. But yeah, we are very blessed to be in the beautiful area of Culver City, not far from Sony.
And proud dresser owners.
Proud dresser, IKEA.
You know, you said for that whole first year, you weren't even taking in-person pitches. Do you think that the advice you were given from that producer to move to LA would still apply to the kid in Plowville? Would you still recommend that he move to LA?
Yes, I would. Now, especially that we're meeting in person again, there's something about just the energy of a room, you know, just like pitches, but when you're meeting someone in person, just feeling that energy from them and just having the access, like one of the greatest things I did for my writing career was just getting involved in other things, like getting involved in the church, joining a dodgeball team, being involved at Penn State football games, because inevitably you're going to meet other people that are in this industry, but you just form personal bonds. Like usually you maybe work, you know, you might talk about work a couple of meetings down the road, but especially with St. Monica's, that Catholic community, it was really just loving spending time with these people and talking about things you love. And then, oh, we both love making movies. Like, what if we tried working on something together? But it happened very organically. It was never like I had like a bunch stack of scripts hidden under my car seat. And I was like, oh, hey, you work for, you know, you work for Sony. Mind giving this a read? No, it was just very organic. So I think that aspect of it, you need to be out here forming those communities. And again, trying to lift each other up in your respective crafts just because you enjoy each other as human beings. And, you know, if a creative endeavor comes out of it, great. If not, you have a wonderful friend. So
that probably speaks to also your experience trying to apply cold for these assistant jobs and then not hearing anything back.
Yes, 100%. Like having a warm connection to a place goes a very long way. Even if it's just, Rebecca, I love you for these. There are these things called, I know I'm the guest, but I'm going to call you on these. They're called arrow emails, I call them. It's just on the keyboard. It's like the little like side V. And then you create it, basically you create an arrow with two names and saying, hey, here's this person. Here's what they love and here's what they love to do. And then here's this person. I think you two would get along. And I've taken that model and I've introduced a lot of people thanks to your generosity, Rebecca. So arrow emails, AKA just linking people up that you think would would have synergy, whether creatively or just personally. Like that's a really easy thing that you can do for someone. And so, yeah, that's how I met Mikey Ritter and Faith and Monisha, like lots of amazing creatives thanks to you. So shout out.
Thank you so much. These are all people too that he just mentioned that are definitely going to be on this podcast at some point or another.
They need to be.
Yeah, thank you for that, Mike.
Of course.
Okay. What things would you say you learned in formal education versus real world experience? And I'm sure anyone listening to this point has an inkling of how this is going to go. But was there anything that you learned in formal education or that you would recommend people look for in their formal education experiences?
Listen, I love Penn State. I'm very proud of my degree. We are Penn State. I really am. And I think just working on a deadline and having a due date is one thing that I could take away. And when you're in school, you have, like, we had to do a senior film, you know, we had a hard deadline and you're balancing that with 12 other credits, which often happens, you know, with your writer, whether it's multiple projects or you have another job. So I think just like setting or like having the capacity to follow through with something from start to finish is something that Penn State taught me that now I carry on with me as a writer. Now, especially now that deadlines are part of it. So there's that. I feel like if I went to like USC or NYU, I might have a little bit more to say on that. But I think it was that. And also, I will say, like, collaborating with various types of people, because our groups were typically fairly random. So you'd have to work with different personalities all for a common goal. And like when they say every movie is a miracle, it is. Like, there's so many people that need to come together over one common goal for a movie to happen. So on a very small level, the experience at Penn State taught me that exact same thing. Is like, we're all in this together for a common goal to create a product that hopefully people will connect with. So I feel like, you know, small scale senior film, very, very low budget versus working on a movie called The Senior for Wayfarer, $10 million movie. Either way, it's like this idea of having a common goal and following through with it because you all believe in something. So there's some great professors over there, like Maura and Rod. They're awesome. And I know Penn State's like, they've done a lot since then. They actually have a Hollywood internship program that wasn't around when I was there, where they bring students out here, which I'm sure would be extremely helpful. So
I know they don't have to cold email their
companies. Yeah. Yeah. So they're making it far more robust. And, you know, hopefully I'd love to get back in whatever way I can, because I think it would be helpful to have longer experience writing longer screenplays. Because I learned to write by reading screenplays of movies I loved. If I watched a movie I loved, I looked up the screenplay and I read it. Like, yeah. Oh, Big with Tom Hanks. That's great. Great movie. Breakfast Club. You can find them online and I would just read them and just try to be a sponge, along with some books. I mean, Save the Cats, kind of the classic structural one. Robert McKee has a great book called Story. So I would just be a voracious reader and pick apart those books. But no, I love Penn State.
No, of course. It's definitely not a knock on any one college. I think that there's just a lot of things people realize that you have to learn through experience.
Oh, yeah.
And there are some things you can focus on trying to learn, you know, through formal systems.
And even just to speak to teaching, you take these classes about instructional design, you're reading these books, and in the books, the kids are engaged and like answering questions, and every kid like is like, me, pick me. And then you get into the classroom and there's like 8 kids on their phone. 3 kids are like fighting over here. It's just an absolute zoo. And you just learn to adapt and figure it out. And that's exactly what a producer has to do. Something goes wrong and you figure it out.
Yeah.
Right. So you learn a lot by making mistakes, and you learn a lot just by not dipping your feet, like diving head first and being willing to make mistakes, because that's how you're gonna learn.
Definitely. Okay, so speaking of your move away from Wayfarer as well, I want to touch on this, because for a while you were doing the writing thing full time and also the executive thing full time, also getting married, which, you know, speaking of teaching to producing experience, you also said there's kind of similarities in wedding planning as well, and then you decided to focus on writing. What were the turning points for you, and were you able to make the commitment to just one of those paths?
Yeah. Let me take you through that. And You're absolutely right about the wedding planning thing. You're an executive producer for your wedding when you get married. Mm-hmm. You have to do craft services.
Wardrobe.
Yeah, you have to cast
Picking
the priest.
Picking your lead is the most important thing.
Location scouting, budgeting.
Totally. I've said this for years as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, right? It's like literally every aspect of wedding planning can be brought back to something in EPing.
Yeah.
So I'm glad I had the experience as a producer before I got married. But so what was happening is the Gift of Peace writing assignment came in that got greenlit. I'm like, okay, I think I can write. I was having a hard time writing while being an exec just on my own specs, simply because you only have a certain amount of creative energy in the tank each day, just like in a workout. You can only work out for so long before you get tired. Mm. And I think that is very accurate in this industry, especially as an executive, because you are exercising that creative muscle for 6 to 8 hours a day in one way or another, whether it's reading a script. So I would come home and see my final draft and be like, not tonight. I need to just chill or have a burrito or something. So I'd push it off. And I didn't come out here to be an executive. And I realized I was not writing much at all. And I wasn't until the Hallmark thing when I had a hard deadline that I was like, okay, like now you need to find the time. And I think it's really important for people who want to write. They're like, oh, what advice do you have? Well, my first one is to write, which sounds very basic, but how often as writers do we put things off for personal reasons? Or there's a million different things. But what I learned to do is, for me, every morning, workout is non-negotiable. I go to Nine Round, which is a kickboxing gym, and get my workout in and come back. It sets my day off right. You have to think of your writing or whatever craft you're in the same way. It's non-negotiable time. Treat it like that workout. Treat it like whatever habit that you have that you're very consistent with. And for me, it's time. It's less, oh, I want to do 3 to 5 pages. I think that's not very helpful, because some days you'll be rewriting and you'll cut 6 pages. That's a productive day, but you didn't do 3 pages, right? So for me, it's more about the time, especially now that I'm writing full time. It's important that I get, you know, X amount of hours in every day. But so I got married in October to Tracy, and the production went swimmingly. And around that time, Gift of Peace, I had to turn Gift of Peace in. And I was able to do it. It was difficult, but I just really pushed myself through it. And well, Tracy and I had been talking about, you know, now that it was us together as a, you know, married couple, things like weekend read are never going to go away as an executive. You're always going to have scripts to read on the weekend. And as soon as you get married, it's no longer a me, it's a we. So we had discussed about what the next step might be. And around this time, and I had been praying about it a lot, around this time, Hallmark was really happy with the Gift of Peace. They reached out about the Blessing Bracelet. And then Jack's Final Five, someone reached out about that. And then the Robbie Heil, based on a true story, like 2 months later, someone reached out about that. And then Once Upon Again, and the animation thing came. And all of a sudden, like, I'm like, okay, clearly these prayers are getting the fast pass. All these, I'm just getting this feeling that it was becoming time where I needed to focus fully all my creative energy. I couldn't dedicate 3/4 of that tank to my creative executive job while still trying to keep up with 3-4 deadlines. It just wasn't possible. And I went over the numbers with Tracy, and it was very, very important to me that I could do it responsibly, especially financially, which I could, thankfully. So at that point, I told Wayfair, I am very grateful for this experience, but writing is what feeds my soul. And I know I've said that a couple times, but I think it's a good way to kind of think about your passion. It should feed your soul in a positive way. And I left, and Wayfair was very supportive, and it was a very warm exit. We ordered Olive Garden on the final day per my request.
Mike's big on Olive Garden, everyone.
Best Italian in Los Angeles.
As someone that went to Italy on their honeymoon.
I know. Well, it goes back to being a kid and being from a rinky-dink town where the best Italian was Olive Garden. So it's kind of a running gag that I go there every year on my birthday. But yeah, so we got Olive Garden, and I'm still very much in touch with Wayfair.
Yeah, you have a project set up there. So,
yeah, I have a project there, and I'm just rooting for them to do well. I know there's still a new company. There's a lot of really exciting projects on their slate, which was the hardest part about leaving, besides some of the wonderful people that work there. So I was able to exit that job in early March, so what, about 3 months ago, and have been able to focus on my craft up until May 1st. And looking at my whole like journey for it to come full circle back to writing is just something that I had hoped for but didn't expect. So when it came, I was just very, very, very grateful.
Yeah. Are there any early collaborators that you still work with?
Yes. So Lawrence Mott, he was the executive at State Street, who was on Action for many years. He actually writes as well. So we're co-writing and working on something.
Script 31.
Script 31. I've also co-written with my sister, which was fun. We've done two pilots. It's funny because, you know, we were siblings. We were 15 months apart. So we would fight and like be annoying to each other and, you know, argue over things. And then when we wrote a pilot, it was just we would have to like debate and argue over plot points and stuff. But it was a fun experience just to like bond on it on a creative level like that, whether something ever comes to the scripts or not. It was just something that we really enjoyed together. But yeah, so Lawrence Mott, you know, I keep in touch with a lot of folks from the very beginning, like Lisa Bruce, I'll still grab a coffee with her. I keep a spreadsheet of everyone I've met and
wise.
Yes. And when I last reached out to them, when I last got coffee with them, where they work, because it's like musical chairs in this industry. People are always looking for their next gig and promotion. So yeah, everyone I met along the way. And it's cool because like some of the people I met early on who were interns from college or assistants now, you know, they're coordinators or CEs. My friend Josh Z, he's a really great manager. Josh Zakaria, he's a really great manager and producer now. And I met him when he was at Chapman. He was a senior in Chapman. So, I mean, I just go by the mantra like, D-bad, don't be a dick. Be kind to everyone. Doesn't matter if they're working the mailroom. I mean, it's a general life philosophy. I know some of your other guests on the pod have said this. Yeah, just be nice and try to lift people up and good things will come back to you. And that's why, I always just try to keep in touch. Or, you know, my one friend's a big LAFC soccer fan. If there was a big soccer news today. So I reached out and texted him about that. It's like, again, just like not always asking about their industry film side, just saying, you know, how are you doing personally? I have a couple friends who are wedding planning, so I make the joke about producing a wedding, you know what yeah. I mean? So it's just being invested in their lives in a genuine way. And, you know, hopefully I will find ways to collaborate with them. And yeah, all the Wayfair folks I keep in touch with, and the assistants and I meet for drinks here and there. So I think it's just important to always just see how people are doing because life can be hard.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, before we get onto the time capsule segment, I want to talk about your navigation of representation because you've gone, you know, you've had a couple different managers, different experiences. What was that like? What would your advice be to someone looking for that first manager?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I get that asked that a lot when I meet with young writers.
Yeah, of course.
And so I'll say originally, I actually got hip pocketed in 2015 by UTA for Jack's Final Five.
And for those that don't know, hip pocket, that just means that they're negotiating one deal, but not signing for a long-term relationship as a client.
Perfectly said. Yeah. So I had been hip pocketed through, it was someone who, it was a reader. One of the people who read Jack's Final Five as a reader ended up passing it up along to an agent because they liked it. Nothing came of it, which is fine. Again, the best thing for a writer out here is to get a read. So I'm never going to be upset if my work's getting read by people. So that didn't work out. I think I still have the voicemail on my phone because it was from a UTA agent. I remember like flipping out in 2015. Like, I made it. I don't know how many times in the first 2 years I was like, I made it.
I didn't,
but I was getting these victories. And
how old were you at that point too? Really
quickly. Yeah, sure. I was 26 when I moved out here.
Okay.
So now I'm 34. Yeah. So again, old enough to know the VHS life. I like some of the other guests like were digital. I'm like, man, that would have been nice. We had horrible time code issues back in college that I can go down that path. But man.
Well, and we're just mean to point out, I think a lot of people feel so behind if they haven't landed all of these things by age 23, you know,
Not at all. Not at all. There's like a spreadsheet of some really, really now famous creatives that made their big break in mid, early, late 30s, 40s, even 50s.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any, you know, you're never too old to have an opportunity to have the shot out here. I don't think I would argue against putting a timeline on it at all. That can be discouraging. So my first manager, by the way, was when I was developing Action. It was like a year and a half in. Mitch was just like, are you repped? He just asked, are you repped? And at the time I wasn't, because you can query, and querying is just sending a cold email to a rep saying, here's a script I've written, here's what it's about, I'd love for you to read it. If you get a 2% response rate, that's probably good. It's just cold emails are so hard. It's not impossible. I've heard of people getting repped through cold emails, but it's just very difficult to do so, especially if you don't have like a Nichols fellowship or a contest win or anything.
Yeah.
But anyways, he just asked, do you have a manager? He's like, I have a guy I think you'd vibe with. So he linked me up with my first manager and we did connect. And I think when you're looking for reps, you're just looking for people that really understand what type of content you want to bring to the world and support that and will push you. And they also have to really know the market, because we always said as an executive, let the market decide if this is a project that they want. You know, if you get all passes, it's not that it was a bad script, it's just that's not what the market's looking for right now. So I got linked up with my first manager and it was fine. I mean, I always, even now, go by the mindset as if I'm not repped. That keeps me hustling, that keeps me keeping these relationships warm, even though I am. And in my rep now, he's at Artist First, his name's Brian Walsh. He's very helpful.
Shout out to Brian.
Yeah, Brian Holly Walsh is his nickname. Great guy. But having that mindset that I'm unrepped just always has me being proactive and trying to link up with folks and keeps me hustling. You have to hustle out here. Anyways, so the first manager, he was fine. It was mainly me bringing deals to him and him like negotiating. And, you know, I was really looking for someone that would also champion projects and bring them out to the world. So right around when I left my first manager is when Action was starting to get traction, which it was kind of nice because I had this project that was tangible that could potentially show my legitimacy. So at that time, I told the execs from Action, hey, if you guys know any managers that might vibe with me, why don't you send them Action? And I sent it to Brian. He flipped for it. And then we've had a great relationship since like 2018-19. I will say this, just talking to a lot of folks in the industry, and I think like 95% of people out here will say they're underrepresented. It's something you hear a lot of. And I think like you just have to evaluate a relationship with a manager almost like a romantic relationship, meaning it has to be mutually beneficial. You want to be getting something from them and you want to be giving them something. If you're not giving them anything to sell, you can't be blaming your manager. And also know that they could have 20, 30, 40 clients. There's a reason you're their client. They believe in you, but know that just like an executive has 30 projects, they have to
balance
and prioritize. So yeah, all my managers came pretty organically through relationships that I had already had out here. I do know a lot of reps scour the blacklist site. I had people reach out to me once I was repped. So there's that avenue as well. They're potential through contests. I think contests are super thankless. I wouldn't recommend writers go that path, but I do know folks that have won contests have success, but it's a very low percentage of getting in that upper level.
Is it kind of like film festivals where it, you know, the Nickel obviously is like the Sundance? Nickel's good.
Yeah. Yeah. So it can get you on people's radar, but I think there's way more organic and your time is better, time and money, because each contest now they're getting pretty expensive, and as it is with submitting to festivals. So I think there's definitely better ways than doing the contest route. But what they say, like there's something they say, like if you write something undeniable, it will get found. And that's true. It sounds dumb, but like if your script is very, very good and people agree across the board that it's very good, people pass around good content and people are very generous about doing that. If they like something and they think someone might vibe with it, they'll do that for you. So just write something undeniable. It's that easy. Not easy at all. Writing a screenplay is really hard. And trust me, Rebecca's right. I've written almost 30. Maybe it is up to 30 now. The first like 12 were absolute. They're horrible. Like I had to take so many of them behind the barn. But you have to write a bunch of bad things in order to get to the good thing. And of course, there's exceptions. People who have like the lightning in a bottle who write something really good right away. But for me, it was writing a lot of just very average, if not bad, scripts to get to ones that I started to get proud of. It's just like what they say about getting your 10,000 hours before you can master something.
Were you ever able to revisit one of those first 12 and improve it, or are they
Yeah. Actually, I did one recently. It was about a guy who worked at a company who had this boss that was just awful to him. And then the guy accidentally discovers that his boss moonlights as the city's supervillain and has to serve as his henchman to save his family. And which is kind of a fun premise, but the original script was garbage. And I was like, nah, but that like I talk about playgrounds of a premise. I'm like, that's a playground. You can have fun with that. So I went back and did a punch up, and now it's something that like I think is a very solid sample of like action comedy with like some fun set pieces and whatnot. It's a big movie, and as a new writer, I don't recommend writing $60 million epics. I mean, I try to write things like, not that I write to a budget, but I try to write things under $10 million, especially starting out. But I always joke about like my first drafts are like a lump of clay. It's a vomit draft. And then the rewriting is when you form that clay into like a beautiful pot or a vase.
Yeah.
But you need that lump of clay, which is why I say like hitting fade out or fade to black, that's a huge win. That's a victory, regardless of how bad you might think your draft is. So many people don't even get to that point. So
definitely. Okay. It's time for our time capsule segment.
I know, I'm ready. I've been studying your episodes.
Mike is a very supportive friend and avid listener.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm a Doyle dude, or whatever the fanboys for this podcast are. Yes.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so we can start with the past. If you could write a letter to yourself 10 years ago, what would you say?
Be patient, stay humble, be gracious, and look for a girl named Tracy Frelo at a bar in earlier than 2018, because she's going to be your wife. But yeah, I would. And yeah, be patient and always do what you love and try to find joy in that as well.
Would that advice change if it was 5 years ago? So I guess that's the year that you met Tracy, but it sounds like it worked out for you. So whatever you said was pretty smooth.
Well, it was Cinco de Mayo, so whatever the tequila had me say was very smooth. So 5 years ago, I would just say keep going. You had that question about being jaded and embittered. Yeah, absolutely. I had many projects fall apart. I had gotten passes left and right. It's really easy to get discouraged, as tough of a skin as you have, but you have to bet on yourself and believe in yourself. And I really felt like I had something to say on the page. So I would just tell myself, keep going, which I did. So good job, 5 years ago, me.
Okay, getting to the present, what is the best movie you've seen in the last year?
Oh, Spider-Verse, the new Spider-Verse. That movie is phenomenal. It's just a marvel of storytelling, a marvel of animation. Daniel Pemberton's score is awesome. That's all I listen to is pretty much scores. It's like, I don't know if you've seen it, but run, don't walk to see that film. Spider-Verse, was it Through the Universe? The new one? I'm trying to think of before that. Oh, Tracy and I had watched Marcel the Shell with the Shoes On.
Thank you.
Boom.
Okay.
Yes.
So Carrie Siegel, who is the previous episode, she also said that. And I'm just so happy because that was I just thought that was such an underappreciated film last year. It was so good.
So lovely.
I cried the whole thing.
Yeah, we both were just bawling our eyes out. But what a wonderful film and with a great message.
Yeah.
And it makes you laugh. It makes you cry. It makes you feel better about the world. Like, that's kind of mine and mantra with the writing too. So I was like, every once in a while I watch a movie, I'm like, dang, I wish I wrote that script. That was one of them. So it was Peanut Butter Falcon, which is not in the last year, but what a lovely film.
Another good movie. What is your favorite song right now? This might be a score for you.
It probably is a score. I'm constantly discovering new ones. I'm writing an inspirational sports movie, so I've like put Rudy on repeat just because that's like the perfect, like the final game montage score is like perfect for what I'm writing. And I always try to write to a score that embodies what I'm feeling. Like if it's a rom-com, I'll try to listen to the holiday score. So yeah, to pinpoint an exact song, I feel like Spider-Verse is just the answer to all these questions. Because I listen to that score, and the one that is when they're going through a different version of New York. I don't want to spoil the movie, but there's a song that I've been listening to there on my runs because it's got a real good pace to it as well. So,
and that's the score?
Yeah, Daniel Pemberton. Yeah, he's so good. That score is like unbelievable.
Okay, what food or drink item are you currently obsessed with?
Oh man, I talk about food all the time. I could probably do a podcast.
At Olive Garden, sponsor Mike's.
Yeah, if we could get reviews. The OG to sponsor this episode, that'd be awesome. Wow. A singular food item.
Or it could be a restaurant.
Carousel is amazing. It's a Sardinian Italian restaurant. Half of it is like a espresso coffee spot, which I every Thursday morning, I take my computer and write there for a couple hours. So if you want to see me, I'll be at Carousel on Thursday mornings. McDonald's, please bring back the spicy McNuggets. But yeah, no, I think the Carousel menu as a whole is my latest food craze.
I think every time Mike and I meet for lunch, we also go to Carousel. Shout out Vincenzo. Go to Carousel Vincenzo, in Culver City.
Oh, so good.
So recently you got married and moved into a new house. What is the piece of furniture or interior decor that you've been enjoying the most?
Oh, dang. We have this wonderful electric fireplace. Even though it's electric, it's just like, it just sets the mood. And when I'm writing, I have nice music and can look at the fire. So there's that. And I think Tracy ordered a hot tub the other day, and also the in-unit laundry dryer. I think we all remember the days of the apartment complex having to like walk, you know, down a flight of stairs or across the street to do laundry.
Totally.
But having that literally 5 feet away is, yeah, so underrated.
That's really a life of luxury. And if you don't live in Los Angeles, or
you've made it when you have the dryer, washer, and a dresser.
What was the favorite detail of your wedding in the fall?
Okay. Yeah, I think you were there, right? Yes, you were. Of course you were there. Yes.
Straight from Germany.
That's right. Yeah, not jet lagged at all. So this was one of my personal touches, and I had this dream for many years, but I really wanted a buffalo sauce fountain at my wedding. You know, like the fondue things. So it was pouring buffalo sauce. And of course I got Chick-fil-A nuggets so people could dip the nuggets into the buffalo sauce fountain. And really it was a showstopper. However, that was also the biggest mistake, because I forgot to tell the wedding planner no heat, because if you turn the heat on, it coagulates. So the flow out of I don't know if you noticed, the flow out of the buffalo sauce fountain was not quite as strong as I'd hoped. But I've broken that out since then. It's always like the hit of the party. So if you're having a wedding, strongly look into buffalo sauce fountains with nuggets. I'm looking to make that a thing. If you ask my wife, she probably would not say that was her favorite detail, but that was one that I was very... very proud of.
Yeah, I can confirm Mike was talking about that for his wedding. Tracy's probably looking at her white dress and like, is this really what I want to try?
That's true. But we did get a really nice picture of us kind of locking arms like you do with cake, eating our nuggets. Yes.
Yes.
So yeah.
We'll probably post that on the Instagram.
You should, yeah.
What is the most recent lesson that you've learned?
Oh, wow. Great question. Well, I feel like this applies to being on set, but it applies to marriage as well. Over-communicate. Say, you know, what you're feeling. Don't harbor anything. You think little things that you didn't think would bother you, whether it's on set or in your marriage, they do bother you. And it's if they do bother you, it's important to let your partner or your, you know, second AD know. Because if those things fester, just as it affects your set, it affects your marriage as well. So we've learned after a couple learning lessons to just really over communicate, and it really gives you peace of mind and lets you live more comfortably and peacefully.
That's great. That's a great tip. Who would be dream collaborators for you?
Oh, man. Well, after seeing Spider-Verse, Lord and Miller, who wrote and produced it, but also the directors, Peter Ramsey and Kim Powers, were awesome. You know, Brian Grazer is an all-time goat in producing, and he actually sits in front of me at church every once in a while. So,
wow.
Yeah, A-lister at St. Monica's. I'm wondering if I should bring a script for him. But no, it'd be cool to collaborate with someone of that.
Just during the sign of peace.
Someone of that caliber as well. And directorially, I mean, who doesn't love Damien Chazelle's like eye for spectacle? Like, I think he'd be a dream director to work with as like kind of the next generation as well.
What are your current interests or hobbies?
For sure. So 9-round kickboxing, love doing that. Tracy and I will go on hikes together. I'll go get lunch with her on the Sony lot. So we find little adventures to do on the weekends as well. It's just like fun maintaining the home, like feeding the hummingbirds and doing all these like neighborhood life things. So keeping the dishes and kitchen clean, because I am home most of the time. So I need breaks from writing. And I'm also, if you're in the Culver City area, I'm an approved dog walker. So during my writing breaks, I've been going around and walking local dogs for a little bit extra Carousel cash.
Okay, so going into the future, 5 years from now, where do you imagine you will be living?
I mean, we've got a pretty sweet pad here in Culver City. The dream, of course, is to own a home, but it's Los Angeles. It's because right now we're renting. And so I would be very happy still living here. However, if we did move, it would probably be south to Long Beach or Orange County, just a little more family oriented. Or the old joke is like, all, you know, you end up in Pasadena, you start in the west side and then you end up Pasadena when you have kids. But we are very pro Palms, Culver City at the moment. So yeah. I'd be completely fine staying here 5 years from now.
It's a good spot.
It really is.
Is there anything in 5 years you hope will have been invented?
Oh man, self-driving cars that we can rely on that we know will not kill us would be awesome. Just to be able to ride on long road trips, or then you won't have to worry about these crazy LA drivers either.
Yeah.
Because they're nuts.
That's true. Okay, the year is 2028. What is the name of the sequel to The Holiday? the hit film enjoyed frequently by Mike and Tracy.
Yes, and part of our Wi-Fi password, The Holiday. The sequel, The Holiday 2, in-law romance, where they're all their in-laws come in and link up.
The year is 2028. What is your 5-year wedding anniversary gift for Tracy?
You know, she really loves home improvement, so this might sound really basic and simple, but I think like just like a couple $100 Home Depot gift card and let her go nuts. Like, I know it's like not super romantic, but I know she loves doing that, so I'd want her to do something she loved.
What's funny about that too is I looked up, you know how there's a traditional gift for every year, like year 50,
after it's
like
married, yeah, yeah,
year 5 is wood.
What?
So that actually fits. You just maybe got it in the
nice.
Raw form.
There we go. Fits perfectly. Yeah. So Home Depot gift card for my wife.
Amazing. The year is 2028. What is the name of your latest rom-com? And that's one that you wrote.
You know, I hope Imperfect Man gets made and is very successful. So Imperfect Man 2, really imperfect. Or maybe, who knows, maybe we're at the trilogy by that point. One can dream, right? Yeah, who knows? Yeah, I mean, there's just the way our culture is changing with technology and AI and everything. I feel like a lot of movies are going to kind of go down that route. But I just love the traditional, like Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan, Sleepless in Seattle, You've Got Mail. So hopefully I can tap into that. So maybe like You've Got... what's going to be the new way of delivering messages? You've got like mind
telepathy.
You've got telepathy thoughts. There we go.
Okay. Let's leave a voicemail for yourself 5 years in the future. What do you want to say to Mike in 2028?
Hey man. Hope you just enjoyed that Olive Garden dinner that you and your wife went out to. I imagine if you're still doing that, you have a dad bod, which would mean you have kids, which is awesome because I'm feeling you're going to be a great dad. And I just hope you're still doing what you love and finding joy in every day in your marriage and in your craft and just opening people's eyes to all the good that's in the world through your screenwriting. All right, now we got to go see my new movie at the movie theater. You've got telepathy messages. Let's go, honey. Bye.
Perfect. Perfect. Awesome. Well, Mike, thanks so much for sharing all of this today.
This
if people want to connect with you online, where can they find you?
So yeah, I have a Twitter. It's at don't be so grim, 2 M's like my last name. And then I have an Instagram. I think it's Mr. Grim Reaper. It's I created it back when I was a teacher. So it's Mr. Grim MM Reaper 77 because the students called me Grim Reaper. I swear I was nice, but you can follow me on there or DM me on there. But yep, that's what I have in my IMDb as well.
Awesome. And where can they check out the movies that have been produced and what streaming?
So Gift of Peace and Blessing Bracelet are both Hallmark movies. So you should be able to find them on Peacock.
On Peacock.
Yes.
Awesome.
Get that sub.
Again, you're such a prolific writer. You have experience that is pretty unmatched in terms of being on both sides of the table at those early stages. And I just think people would be able to take a lot away from your experience. So thank you so much.
That's my hope. Yep. And I'm truly blessed and blessed to be part of this as well. So thank you, Rebecca.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Here is a recap of some takeaways from my conversation with Mike. 1, fall in love with the process, not the result. 2, to avoid getting jaded from the inevitable lows, redefine what a victory is in this business. The best thing for a writer is to get a read. 3, always keep putting new coals on the fire of your career. When you finish one project, put it out into the universe and then move on to creating the next thing. 4, to build good relationships with executives, take passes with grace, don't check in too often, and be patient. These things take time, and they are working hard behind the scenes. 5,
the conventional wisdom is true. For screenplays, you have to grab them in the first 5 pages. Some of the biggest reasons for passes are that nothing happened or there is a lack of clarity around character goals or stakes. 6. Luck is where opportunity meets preparation. Start preparing. 7. Dive headfirst instead of dipping your feet. You will learn by making mistakes. 8. Connections made over other interests unrelated to the industry often are the most meaningful and help you stay invested in others' lives in a genuine way. 9. Whatever your creative discipline, treat it as a non-negotiable. If you're a writer, write. 10. Measure your writing progress by the time put in, not pages. Sometimes spending hours cutting pages is a productive day. 11. To get in the mindset of your script, consider listening to the scores from movies with similar tones while writing. 12. D-bad, don't be a dick. Try to lift people up and good things will come back to you. And 13. If you write something undeniable, it will get found. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of No Set Path. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to rate it and share it with a friend, especially if you can think of someone who might benefit from the knowledge that was shared here today. You can keep up with the podcast on all social platforms at No Set Path Show or on the website at www.nosetpathshow.com. Thanks so much for being part of this community, and we'll talk to you soon.